y'all should kick rocks. There's supply and there's demand, and all of y'all are in stock. I don't make the rules, and I don't make shit for TikTok. Thought they get it past me, but that shit is getting picked off. Run it back, type to drop a line and make them hit pause. I'ma get so many plaques that they gon' think I didn't floss. My man's in my ear from right behind, he sound like Rick Ross. The way he pull me back into his balls, it's like a slingshot. Kids, this is laminar flow. He put his hand on my throat, I handle it though, I'm channeling gold. Making them freeze, their head in a mannequin pose. Hand the remote, I'm changing the game. I give them the business and word and stand on them both. I got liquor in a glass of water, both of them look the same. Russian roulette and throw them back like right before I hit the stage. I get up there and go crazy when they say my fucking name. I don't need support on tour, I just let the titties hang. He's a one-night stand, a one-hit wonder, call him Chitty Bang. I took bullshit from my ex and I turn it to Minute Maid. I lay one brick at a time, still don't know when I'm getting paid. I go MJ on the beat like Eminem J on Renegade. Ben and Frank been trying to call me, think it's time I pick it up. Find these beats on YouTube, I know that search bar is sick of us. Too many Portland athletes in my DMs saying their dick is up. If I spilled the tea, I know you dirty freaks would lick it up. Yeah, show me some.
Oh boy.
That's the one you picked.
Yeah. Cedric, what are you doing to me?
But I think we missed the beginning of that one there. That kind of,
I think we got enough.
Tease it up. I think it's pretty dope. Well, happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday.
It's good to see you, brother.
Yes, sir.
How you
Welcome
been?
Welcome to the Arctic Circle. Florida refugees coming down here trying to find the warm weather. Welcome.
Welcome back to Bitcoin Center, live stream number 38. Please hit like and subscribe. Brought to you by Bite Federal.
Yeah, check that out, guys. We got 1,400 ATMs, 41 states, Bite Wallet, which is a custodial on-ramp, Bite Vault, which is a non-custodial, hold your own coins, keep it safe and secure, and of course, our point-of-sale system with some very exciting payments coming up in the near future. We'll be telling you more about it.
Yeah, speaking of states, how was your last 2 weeks at Bite Federal?
It was a blast. Tell you all about it someday when we can talk about it. We're not allowed to talk about these things.
Fair enough. All right, cool. Well, you got to deal with the regulatory agencies and you're a regulated business, and that has its sort of trials and tribulations.
Absolutely. It is the cost of doing business, my friends.
Yeah, and they're talking a lot about sort of regulation and frameworks over at Davos.
They like it there.
You know, did you catch any of it?
I watched a few clips. I let X feed me when I
what
works for my algorithm.
Anything stick out, or did you see?
Oh, what stuck out? What really stuck out the most to me was that you know, the World Economic Forum has changed their changed their rhetoric, changed their pitch, changed their story. Still trying to achieve the same thing, just not through globalization and ESG narratives. They're trying to achieve it now through AI and a reorganization of the global world order. But I think they're on the path to try and obtain the same goals, just through different mechanisms with a different narrative.
What did you think of Trump speaking there?
Yeah.
Good.
I mean, that's true.
Wasn't his speech?
Only shocking from the perspective of.
I don't think it's shocking.
Well, I mean, I think people would assume it's shocking from the perspective of like, oh my God, this is so different than what the World Economic Forum would say 2 years ago, right? Like, you're not Klaus isn't there. Yuval Navari isn't all over the place saying, you know, we don't need humans. They all just need to go away, and you know, they'll just eat bugs and be happy. So that narrative has changed. But the end result, to make one world government controlled by the wealthiest financial infrastructure on the planet, reorganizing itself to deliver a technocracy, it's the same end goal in my mind, yeah. Right? That's the way I'm looking.
Well, wasn't it framed? I mean, the speech, I think, was anti sort of Davos.
Yeah, sure.
People's,
but isn't that exactly what you would want if you're trying to get the same goal?
Exactly.
Holy cow, like our pitch isn't working. Our marketing deck is failing. We better come up with a new narrative to sell the same stuff.
Right. I mean, just connect the dots. I mean, Larry Fink runs Davos now in the World Economic Forum, and Fink's number two guy or number three guy is being nominated for the Federal Reserve Chair, I think, today. So, you know, I mean, they seem to be on the same team there.
Yeah, 100%. And it's not, okay, let's not focus on tokenizing the environment and carbon credits as much as we can tokenize everything else. we will tokenize the environment. We're just not going to be the peak point in our narrative, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same old game, new story, new pitch. You just got to read between the lines.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're getting to all the news of the week. Let's get into the show now.
Do it.
Can't wait. Please hit like and subscribe. This is Bitcoin Center, brought to you by Byte Federal.
Let's be real, right? Praising Telegram for launching a Bitcoin wallet. I've always felt like Vitalik.
Bitcoin, this digital currency that's out there that people say, oh, it might be the next big thing. What do you think?
I think it's rat poison.
Bitcoin. You never heard of them a few weeks ago? Now everybody's talking about them, but is it a currency?
I don't know. Or is it more like a stock? Or is it a tulip bulb?
Or is it just
debate that?
Stupid.
To me, it smells like Ponzi scheme and the greater fool theory, right?
You do like 5 minutes of freaking research.
Well, good. Thanks for coming to my set talk.
Yes.
Don't buy Bitcoin.
Oh, man, I always get that wrong. All right.
Bitcoin's recent rally.
Do you agree? Is crypto finally dead?
Go to the next one.
Matter of fact, they're kind of in the Ethernet. What are they?
There's some rumors that it's this Japanese guy, but they're saying no, that he's a fake name. It was a pseudonym.
You're literally putting real money onto a system that we don't even know who created it.
It will come to a bad ending.
Is this the most exciting bull run ever?
Not for me. No, it's not.
Welcome to Bitcoin Center, the fast-paced show where the debate is the story.
Governor, you have to address this. Is the euro in danger from a Bitcoin standard?
No, I'm a bit skeptical, Brian. Sorry to say it about this idea of the Bitcoin standard. We left the gold standard, but the gold was only a technical mean. What is important is what you say, Bert, that monetary policy and money is part of sovereignty. And we live in democracies, and I think the public role is key. And if we lose that, really you lose a key function of democracy. That said, I always keep repeating that money, as long as it exists for centuries, has been a public-private partnership. You need a public anchor, whatever its form is. Remember, and silver and gold were sovereign assets, so it was on the public side. And then you had banknotes, and you will have CBDC. But anyway, the most important part of payments is in the private sphere, and this is the development of tokenized private money. But this tokenized private money must be regulated to inspire trust, confidence.
It's fascinating that you say that. Brian, you mentioned a complementary role that you could play.
So I think that crypto is very good for fiat currencies. It's very good. Bitcoin is like good as a check and balance on deficit spending, because when there is a lack of trust, or people, you know, from like in a U.S. context, if people are worried about inflation, or maybe in places like Argentina or Turkey or Nigeria, they are going to flee to the thing that they believe is going to store value more. So I think in general, it's going to be very complementary. And like you said, I think it comes down to trust. And so if fiat currencies can maintain trust and not have, you know, the money printer kind of debasing everybody, then they'll survive. But if they countries that, you know, have bad behavior on that dimension, Bitcoin doesn't have a money printer. The supply is fixed, and people will go to it in times of uncertainty, kind of like they did with gold.
The guarantee for trust is independence on central bank side. And we have a core mandate, and we are accountable to that. But sorry to say that I trust more independent central banks with a democratic mandate than private issuers of Bitcoin, which have a very useful role. But
Bitcoin is a decentralized protocol. There's actually no issuer of it. So that's in the sense that central banks have independence. Bitcoin is even more independent. There's no country or company or individual who controls it in the world. And so, anyway, I think it's a healthy competition, because if people can decide which one they trust more, and I think it's actually the greatest accountability mechanism on.
Oh, the French Central Bank. It's not the French Central Bank. It's the French.
There's a couple levels to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Brian can be a really articulate and well-spoken Bitcoiner when he chooses to be, and he can lean into Bitcoin really hard when he needs to. Maybe he just likes nihilistic gambling as well. And I mean, maybe it's profitable. I can't see how.
What do you mean by the nihilistic gambling? Well,
so on his platform,
he's got
Bitcoin positioned alongside other things. And notice he leaned into crypto to start, which he started that off with crypto is good for fiat currencies, which is a very odd sentence.
Mm-hmm.
You make it Bitcoin is good for fiat currencies, you would say, you know, he kind of elaborates, you know, they kind of keep them honest, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. I can kind of understand that if you're tethered to it or you see it as some sort of psychological mooring, but I don't think the government want to do that. I think that he's, in terms of being well-spoken, he's not it wasn't the deepest conversation about Bitcoin, but to be poised on that stage. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. The other guy I thought was incredibly condescending and mocking.
Imagine that,
you know,
and the independence of the central bank. That was a great comment. I think Brian did a good job with his explanation of Bitcoin in a very politically correct fashion. Good thing we didn't have Saifedean up there. He would have fucking destroyed him. That would have been actually more fun.
But he wouldn't be invited, and that says a lot.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, the French central bank has no clue, right? They obviously don't understand Bitcoin, or they don't want to admit that they understand it, and because by doing so, they would empower it. So
seems like an authentic lack of understanding.
It could have been,
or maybe you could say maybe they're just the misusing line, words. Right? But you know, saying the private issuers,
yeah. This is crazy.
You could argue though that if there was one or a few people,
I like the Brad Garlinghouse is just sitting back there going like,
"What?" Oh, I don't think we're covering this on the show.
The whole time I wanted to be like, Brad, what do you think about trust?
There's a really interesting clip floating around from Joe Squawk Show Morning. Right, Joe Scarbo. I think not Joe Scarbo.
Squawk Box.
Squawk Box. About. Yeah, from like 2009.
Okay,
I think it's September. September 9th, 2008 or 2009, and they're having a conversation. Brad is it's announced on that show that Brad's going from Yahoo to he's the one who wrote the he wrote the Project Peanut Butter manifesto.
No idea what you're talking
about.
This is interesting though.
They're talking about how the UN needs a new global reserve currency. This is like 2009,
right?
On Squawk Box, and then it's announced that Garlinghouse is moving. It was just an interesting coincidence.
I mean,
regarding Garlinghouse,
Ripple has been trying to get in bed with the central banks for I don't know God how many years, like even before or right around the same emergence of Bitcoin, and you know it's amazing how good they are at marketing. And how much traction they can get from their marketing while simultaneously it's made them incredibly wealthy and done nothing for humanity. So,
yeah, I think there's still people that believe that Ripple will be the global reserve currency. And that's sort of a QAnon.
There's still a ton of people that think that, you know, the token Ripple is actually being used by banks.
Right.
They think that's what they think. They think, the price of my token's going to go up because the banks are going to use it. It's like, no, people.
There is
you're financing Ripple's ability to sell their services to banks. It's not going to show up in the value of your token.
Do you think anything coming out of that for-profit Ripple group, any technology has been deployed or being utilized in any way, shape?
Think about it. Where did that all come from? Where did all the blockchain technology come from? All the different iterations, all the different versions, right? So it's all out in the open space anyways. Anybody can copy code and duplicate it and change it and tweak it and relaunch a new chain. And so I think they're probably, the token holders of Ripple are financing Brad and his team to
marketing.
Go around and attend the World Economic Forum and mingle and rub shoulders with really wealthy people. And they probably drop bits and pieces and they get, you know, they share some technology things. But I mean, how does that roll downhill to the token holders?
Yeah, no, I'm not imagining that, but I'm just wondering.
It's so sad that somebody that is basically fleecing token holders gets a seat there. I mean, whatever. Moving on.
All right, let's move on. Let's play the next clip.
So I'm not going to tell you that there is a red line. I'm not going to tell you that central banks will always be around either. But I think that the nature of the purpose for which debt is subscribed will matter more than the actual volume.
Speak to what you did. You just said something very interesting.
No, I'm
you
not
said,
going to speak more to it.
No to the idea that central banks might not always be around. What did you, mean by that?
Look, I went through my lot of crisis, as many of you have as well. And I remember the days when it was mentioned that, you know, central bankers are the only game in town. This is not the right approach to a balanced and durable equilibrium. Measures have to be taken by fiscal authorities. Reforms have to be undertaken. The purpose for which spending is organized has to be thought through, and the consequences on people if we want society to stay together.
Right. So just not trying to put words in your mouth, but are you basically saying that in our legislative branches around the world, we have abdicated responsibility of being fiscally prudent and thoughtful as to how we use society's resources and have become overly reliant upon central banks to continue to try to keep the economy going in the right direction against this onslaught of reckless spending?
I'm not suggesting it's the case now, but we have observed it in the...
Dude, it's so crazy to watch Christine Lagarde try and tell the truth.
Do you think she's gradually changing here or recognizing reality or...
I think
the slow rollout of all of it and is just sort of managing her own progression through that.
So when I started to think about what she was saying there, right? The first comment that obviously caught everybody's attention is that, you know, central banks, I can't say central banks will be here forever. So when I started to think about that in the way that the world is being restructured, where you have a multipolar world that looks to be headed by the US, China, and Russia. Two of those parties aren't a part of the Western central banking system. And the third one, the United States, who still has it, is attacking the Federal Reserve through a lawsuit, through all sorts of, you know, agendas that are meant to create doubt in the viability of the central bank, right? Even if it's just from the perspective of have they ever achieved their mandates? Have they ever provided anything good, right? They're sowing question into the central bank's viability in the United States. I think that's for two purposes, the reason why that's being done in the United States. I think that's being done because they want to bully the central bank into playing ball with the fiscal needs of our government. So get on board, or we're going to just make you look horrible. And then the second order effect could be that if fiscal policy fails in the United States and we don't get out from under this massive debt crisis, they have a scapegoat and they can have somebody to blame it on. And so the central bank dies either way,
right?
Either dies through co-option or dies because it becomes a scapegoat of a failed economic policy. So then that leaves you with a new world order where you basically, if you want to compete with China and Russia, you need to have a state central bank. You need to have a bank that's working hand in hand with the government, because these are existential moments of survival for these sovereigns when it comes to, you know, breaking international law to gather resources, setting up a new world order. How are we going to invest? Who's going to be the manufacturer of this for the globe? Who's going to supply the energy for the globe? Who's going to supply the AI and the chips? And right? So you see these three different entities as this multipolar world, but what's sitting at the top of it, the head of the octopus, is the financial complex that's global, which is why I'm looking at the WEF is like, nothing's really changed there, just the message.
Right.
So I think what she's saying is, absolutely true. I think she sees it coming, where the role of Western central banks is significantly diminished.
She used to pretend like she didn't see it coming, though, much more angry about it and lashing out.
I think she got the message that the time is coming, and get with the program. No, that's my take.
I hear you. All right. Let's see. I'm just asking Francis, who's going to play this next clip, me or him?
The kill switch clip.
No.
We're going to go on another.
I want to go back to this crazy clip from 2009 on CNBC.
Oh, okay. Let's do it. This is the peanut butter debacle.
It's try playing it now. I'll try playing it now.
I could play it.
Is this what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'll play it without the. We'll just hear the audio. Oh, actually.
Executive Brad. And AOL has hired former Yahoo executive Brad Garlinghouse to run the company's email group and beef up its presence in Silicon Valley. Garlinghouse might be known for calling attention to major problems at Yahoo in a 2006 internal memo. That paper was referred to as the Peanut Butter Manifesto because it claimed the company had spread itself too thin. Since then, Yahoo has changed CEOs twice. Since leaving Yahoo last year, Garlinghouse has been an advisor at private equity firm Silver Lake Partners. And coming up, is it time to ditch the dollar? The United Nations calls for a new global currency. So could this herald the biggest overhaul of the world's monetary system since World War II? And
well, that was an interesting little find. It's interesting how these people pop up over and over again. And
I mean, the UN and the IMF, they've always, you know, been hovering around this SDR issuance. They've been hovering around a global reserve currency made up of a basket of other currencies, blah, 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 because they've known this time is coming.
Right.
But to where we are today, all that stuff is gone. All those plays are gone. They never got any traction. All those narratives never got any traction. And what's left is world superpowers deciding how they're going to divide up the world. And you're going to get to use digital currencies that are controlled by financial infrastructure, and you'll be able to hold Bitcoin in self-custody. And if you don't have it in self-custody, you will not have any money that you control.
Right. But I think they're going to push really hard to make self-custody harder and harder.
Oh, absolutely. That's the fight. That's the most important fight in everything we're doing right now is self-custody.
And privacy around the self-custody. 100%. They go hand in hand.
Yeah. But self-custody, I think, is step and priority number one.
Agreed.
Because the amount of people that are taking self-custody, moving coins to cold storage, are running their own nodes, supporting the network, mining, however they're participating, are giving us the future footprint and power to start to make protocol changes, layer two changes, layer threes that could then provide privacy for individuals. And we're not talking about privacy for criminals and drug dealers and pedophiles. We're just talking about privacy to own your own wealth, transact with friends and family and businesses that are local, and not constantly be under surveillance.
Yeah.
Right? Just a natural right to privacy that has existed prior to the creation of technology. We just want to port that into the future. So we're not asking for everybody to be able to break the law. We want law enforcement to do law enforcement. We want law enforcement to catch the bad guys, and we want to help them do that. But at the same time, good people shouldn't have to give up their freedom and financial privacy because of a few bad actors. And I think that if humanity can work together on that front, and I think to push that effort, it starts with self-custody. It starts with a large percentage of Bitcoiners that hold a significant amount of wealth and then hold it in a self-sovereign fashion. Then that wealth will beget the changes in the law that need to happen to build a future we want to see.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I wish I had more evidence of humanity going in that direction. We can talk about the House voting on remote vehicle kill switches.
Yeah, this is creepy.
We've talked
about this for a while, right? We've talked about this as a risk with a lot of the modern vehicles. it just kind of hit me out of nowhere. Like, do you have any, I had no idea this was even being voted on. Did you?
Right. So we've talked about this offline for a while, like, but Bitcoin community, I've never seen anything that was kind of being rolled out before this or talked about on a national level.
The first I heard of it, saw of it, was just like, oh, the vote's done.
Yeah.
Like,
so,
and it was it.
What? Something I wanted to, okay. To me, it seems like everything is just kind of going really according to plan. And I don't mean that there is a planet, or I feel like the things just feel like you go from like version 1.1, it's just very smooth and predictable.
Dude, it's been
especially
happening
in retrospect, obviously. This,
like, it's been happening since the early 2000s, in that back then we called it the pussification of America. Like, everybody was so politically correct, you couldn't say anything without upsetting people. And then that became, we're going to censor and or demonetize or reduce the signal if what you're saying is not politically correct, but popular. And now it's being put into law, meaning we're doing it for your safety narrative. So many people vote for this, like, I want to live in a plastic safe bubble where nothing can hurt me. I'm willing to give up all freedom to have that.
So,
like, that's just pervasive through everything we're talking about.
Right.
Like, taking self-custody, that's a risk. Like, being free is a risk. Taking sovereignty is a risk. Right? Driving your car without it being able to automatically have somebody turn it off to save you is a risk, right? So it's like, we're going to de-risk ourselves into slavery because nobody's willing to take the risk and a chance of being hurt, damaged. Like, that to me is like handing over your humanity in exchange for slavery. Because you don't want to put a freaking Band-Aid on a scrape. Like, it's really upsetting to me, if you can't tell.
So, did you see that clip with how Edward Dowd, who brought up how most, if you talk about sort of humanity in terms of at least North America and retirement funds and wealth, and I imagine beyond this, I'm not sure, but it seems like a lot of humanity is investing in things like AI, Netflix, sort of like, you know, digital centralized communications, media. Basically, we're investing in our own digital panopticon.
Sure.
And we're so excited to do it. You know, I met up with an old friend and he was telling us about a buddy who works in AI, as you know, and he's got stock options and he bought some of this stock and he put his life force.
Yeah.
Into rooting on sort of his own.
Yeah. And think about it though. Like, when you're looked at, you're faced with our current situation of a K-shaped economy, either invest with the system and get wealthy or don't invest in the system and get poor. And then when you look at what your options are based on the structure of a passive investing model, your dollars are going to get funneled into the companies that are most supportive of the network you're describing. And so how do you opt out of that and get wealthy? There's only one. It's Bitcoin.
Yeah, but if that wealth and literally is the wealth, and you can describe wealth in different ways. Health can be wealth, right? So wealth is not the same thing to everyone or on the same, right?
Good point, yep.
But if you just look at it in terms of dollar terms and you enslave yourself, and this is more metaphysical, but if you are giving power to the thing that will end up consuming you, and right. I don't think most people...
Well, this is Jeff Booth's total argument. Like, this is opting out of the system, meaning instead of investing in your future cage, invest in Bitcoin and take it into self-custody. Right. So you can take your dollars out of the system, invest it in Bitcoin, and instead of leaving the Bitcoin in the system, take it into self-custody, put it in cold storage. Now you have the ability to let the network drive your wealth while simultaneously not directly supporting it. And hopefully you get enough self-sufficient, self-sovereign, self-custody Bitcoiners that attain a significant amount of wealth
And I think you actually find real price discovery there.
Right. And that they can now influence policy. They can influence legislation. They can influence government in order to build a freer society. But if we don't have that wealth, we don't have that power, we are not going to be able to get ourselves out of that cage. And so that's why when we hammer the table about self-custody, it's not just some meme that has no meaning. There's a whole bunch of second and third order effects that come down the pipeline from having self-custody wealth that we need to make sure we have the ability to take advantage of in the future. Because this digital gilded cage is coming, whether we like it or not. And so how do you plan to bend the bars and restructure that cage?
Right. Right. Because you might be able to spend your wealth in that gilded cage, but you won't be able to voice it. They can take the dollars away. You can't spend it on campaigning or politicking if they don't agree with these things.
Right.
These lines, though, remember in the cell phone industry, all of a sudden removable batteries just disappeared.
Yes. Yeah.
And every company went to, and it didn't seem emergent.
Right.
It didn't seem like everyone agreed that this was the best way to go forward from a technological or convenience or any perspective from the consumer. And do you think that AI, that anything that's going to be brought out commercially, is any of it experimental in the sense that Sam Altman or Elon Musk or any of these people don't know where things are going, or there's like a roadmap and, you know, they all sort of fight to go maybe be the first mover to the next step or the next thing that's released out. And what I'm also saying is, is there any risk with what any of these companies are doing to humanity? Or what? So if it's all planned and sort of there's a phase that's kind of seen as phase one, phase two, phase three, and all the development and sort of unknowns is, I think, theater, then everything's contained within what they're doing. Like, I don't think there's unknowns.
I want to hear what you think about that as well. But I just real quickly, I think there is a plan that is being driven by financial allocators. Right. So when you look at where the big money is that are taking the big positions in these companies and getting board seats, et cetera, they're driving the plan. And now there's a direct connection with the plan, the head of the WEF, and the controllers of the plan.
Right.
And that's just not US capital. That's Chinese capital. That's Saudi Arabia capital. It's European, like it's global wealth driving that plan. And then that plan could get implemented in a dozen different ways to see which one rises to the surface. But you've got to, you know, when you look at people like Sam Altman and Elon and Bezos, it's like you're and Zuckerberg, you're getting different versions where they're sort of like vying for that capital. So how closely can we build the ultimate solution for their plan? Because then I'll get more capital. And all my company gets better. I get higher in the S&P. I'm going to get more passive flows. I'll get more capital. So it's a constant feedback loop that drives the mission and the purpose of the capital allocators, right? So I think it can have significantly negative effect. It can have very, very good effects when used properly. And like all things in this universe, the good comes with bad, you know, black comes with white and yin comes with yang, evil comes with good. And so it becomes your personal use and your personal application of these tools. It's like humanity has to choose to use this stuff for the best purposes. If it's left to where you've got 8% of the people in the gilded cage with no vote and no voice and no sovereignty and no ability to implement something that's good for them, then you're going to get very bad outcomes. Whereas if it's open to the people to pick and choose and utilize for what benefits themselves and their families, you're going to get better outcomes. So to me, we can't control the capital allocators, but we can control the way we interact with this new future.
Yeah. So think about like with remember MySpace and Facebook?
Yeah.
And you could say, oh, they're competing, and maybe investors, this company wants more CapEx. They need more data. This company thinks they could do it with less people. This company is going to let it have a more uniform approach. This company is going to let everyone do what they want. But the end goal for the military industrial complex is to roll out sort of a digital index of every human possible. And they'll get that whichever company wins. But, you know, you watch something like I get sucked into these. I'm enjoying watching the movie Marvel Universe with my son. I never thought I'd watch these popcorn flicks. But there's one Iron Man where this is like in 2014, they filmed this, where they're working on AI. And there's this debate that if we try to use the AI to solve certain problems or try to give it certain capabilities, it could turn on us. Mm-hmm. We could have a negative outcome that could destroy humanity. And I wonder if they're actually working on technology that could destroy or have really negative outcomes for humanity. And they're trying, you know, the story we're told is that could happen and they're trying not to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they're really working on anything
I think that
could destroy humanity, but I think they might threaten us with these scenarios and I would think that anyone who's working on anything like that is probably outside the purview of these companies and further behind the scenes. But my point is Altman, Musk are sort of, I think, they might be competing on sort of this one's going to do market better for these tasks or interface right. with this data and these parameters. But I don't think they're messing with technology states wouldn't allow them to. Does that kind of make sense?
A little bit. What it reminds me of is that, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so decentralizing AI, decentralizing LLMs, and putting it into the hands of the people as quickly as possible gives us a better outcome structurally. Because if it remains to where, if it remains at the sovereign level where you've got the U.S. government's approved AI and China's AI and Russia's AI, that amount of power and control is going to have very bad outcomes. All big, powerful organizations have led to negative outcomes for humanity. When a technology or a resource is distributed broadly amongst humanity and they're able to tinker with it, then good things will emerge all over the place for different people to latch on and utilize to benefit themselves. So to me, it all comes back to hopefully what we're merging into here as a society is we're sitting at the peak of centralization with hopefully a humanity that's waking up to the fact that decentralizing everything is the solution. I mean, as much as possible, there's certain things that just will not function in a decentralized manner. Your family should not be a decentralized family. Your family should be centralized, for example. But
they've done a great job of decentralizing family.
Right. So, I mean, it's trying to take these monolithic organizations that and turn them into more decentralized use cases. And I think AI has an incredible power to do that.
I think, but don't you think it's going to get more centralized before? Like, I don't think we're at peak yet. I think it's inevitable that centralized forces get a little bit stronger.
You're right. I think it's going to centralize more initially because it's.
And I think it will break. I think it'll get so centralized until it breaks.
It's required to incentivize the gathering of the assets that are needed to build that. Right? It's like they need the power. They need the chips. They need the raw materials. They need all this infrastructure to compete on the global scale with the other hegemons to not be a country that's subservient to somebody else's AI, right? So you have to build that out. And I think centralization will empower that. But I think at some point, even just, you know, a rudimentary LLM is going to provide so much power and in a decentralized fashion to people that can utilize it properly, that it is going to give you the tools that you need to be less reliant on the state if you choose to be less reliant.
I think it could destroy people's cognitive cognitive thought and ability to critically think.
That's a personal problem, right? Like that's. But we're already seeing that today. We're already seeing that today in public education, and we're seeing it across medicine. We're seeing it across so many things where people just choose to not take responsibility for themselves and push it off to some authority for a easy solution, right? I'm not going to go exercise and diet and spend more money on quality food. Just give me the pill, right? So I think people are more and more people that I speak to are making that decision. They're saying, you know, for however they're waking up to that reality, they're making the decision to take more responsibility for their personal life. And I think those people will learn to communicate with AI in a way that it benefits them, right? If you know, they're moving away from AI, give me the answer to, wait a minute, AI, what about this? What about that? What, how should we be thinking about this? What kind of questions do you want me to ask you about this so that I get the answers that I want? Let me ask this AI to write a prompt for you, right? And like when you start really having these more complicated discussions with AI and forcing it, right? You learn that initially it's going to pander to you. And then eventually it gets to the point where it's like, okay, I don't need to pander to Cedric anymore. I know what he wants me to get to. So let's go there right away. And you start using across everything. How do I fix my sink? How do I trade options? How do I raise cattle? How do I build a chicken coop? Like these are the kind of things that are totally different than like, where should I go to dinner?
Right.
You know,
I think it's going to destroy companies.
Oh, I think absolutely.
People are going to be like, why do I have to work with anybody? I'll just build the AI bots that I need.
Right. I think
they don't get tired.
This is what I said. Like, I think I said it on one of your shows, like everybody becomes China. Everybody becomes China in the future. Cause if you take AI, a robot, your knowledge and your needs, and you combine that into self-sovereignty mindset, then you're how do I feed myself? How do I, in this zone, in this district, in this part of the world, with this water and this soil, what plants can I grow? What are the medicinal qualities? It's endless. It's an endless well of knowledge, which is hugely empowering, but you have to use it right. You have to have the right long-term goal, right? If your long-term goal is, you know, where am I going to get the cheapest burger at this and fast food burger tonight? Like who's having the best deal? You're not using it right because you're just using it to do less Google searching.
You weren't here the last couple of weeks. I got to know, what do you think of that Chinese dissident who said she doesn't think there's anywhere near 1.5 billion people in China?
Oh, I think she's dead on.
Yeah.
Makes total sense. The math makes total sense. But a lot of people don't, because a lot, like I talked to people about China's one child policy years back, and they're like, no, that's not real.
Right.
I'm like, what do you mean? It's all like, that's their mantra has been that way forever.
Yeah, I was doing some crock on that. There's no, it's not as enforced. And I shouldn't say it's not. I don't know what's real about China because we get the information generally speaking through American or Western sources.
So the truth is probably somewhere in between the two narratives, right? Is where the truth is, but I don't think China's population is as big as they make it out to be.
Get the notion that you go to a city and I'm like, I don't think there's 22 million people here. Like, I don't know. I've been there and that kind of had that vibe, where you're just like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I could see the numbers being really inflated. I don't know. Because if you think China could do it, even by 10, 20, 30%, which is much smaller number than she was saying, like 1.5 billion down to 500 million. If you just then apply that maybe globally and you think about all the countries who might be sort of incentivized to bump up their numbers.
Right.
I mean, every athlete in the NBA, like I think you take an inch off whatever they're published.
Like the future, height wise. Like we have all these discussions around demographics and like who's got the youngest population, who's going to have the biggest middle class, et cetera. In the future, is that discussion going to be who has the most robots
or drones?
Right. Who's producing robots at exponential factor And did they have the energy to do it? And what does that mean for GDP and blah, blah, blah?
That sounds like a scary world.
It is going to be a scary world. That's all why right. That's why you got to start taking control now.
Let's get to the next clip here about Vegas. Bitcoin Vegas is coming up 2026, but this is a little different
than ever before. And now there's one more. Bitcoin is showing up at checkout counters across the country, including right here in Las Vegas.
And a new report shows more business owners are jumping on board. Our consumer reporter, Shakira Hawkins, explains what this means for local businesses and for you.
You're probably used to tapping your phone or swiping your card, but some Las Vegas businesses are adding Bitcoin as a way to pay. That means the next time you're short on cash, you could use your Bitcoin investment to cover your purchase.
We're accepting Bitcoin now. We're getting quite a few people who's using Bitcoin.
Mike Peterson owns Bounty World Mega Playground and Cafe near Blue Diamond in Decatur. He's been in business for about a decade, and now he added Bitcoin as a new way to pay.
We've seen about a good 30 people that have used it so far.
And Peterson isn't alone. A new report from BTC Map shows the number of businesses accepting Bitcoin jumped 53% in 2025, with more than 11,000 new merchants added just last year alone.
The cost of doing business just across the board has been going up, and they're looking for ways to cut costs.
Bitcoin consultant Jeremy Corchi with Sovin says Bitcoin payments can also be simple for customers.
In this case, you scan a QR code, instantaneous payment.
He says more local businesses are signing on, and that number is expected to grow. One big reason? The financial digital payment company Square offered Bitcoin payments to millions of U.S. businesses with no processing fees through 2026. For small businesses like Bouncy World, that can make a big difference, especially as inflation and credit card fees continue to eat into profits. Peterson says business has been slow, and he's hopeful this new option helps.
Compared to credit card fees, it's a lot less. And that's why I'm very excited about it. It's a fraction of what the credit cards are charging.
Right now, Bitcoin payments are still new, but experts say for some users, it offers benefits like added security and lower fees. For Good Morning Las Vegas, I'm Shakira.
That's great. So what do you think?
It felt like a time capsule. Like that felt like from 10 years ago in terms of...
I think that's just the local news, right?
Yeah, but I mean... What Square did,
hey, at least they're not out of a shed,
right?
Somebody's backyard.
No, the production value was great. It just felt like, wow, this feels like news that should have been relevant 10 years ago.
Oh, right.
And it already feels historical that you could just look back in time. Any time in the future, you'd be like, that makes sense. Businesses started to adopt using it. There's no chargebacks. The fees are better. There's no fees right now.
I think the beauty of merchant adoption is that hopefully they don't have to liquidate it all. Hopefully they can keep some percentage of their Bitcoin payments as a nest egg for their future, right? Because you can't accept the dollar and hold it and get wealthy,
right?
You have to invest it. But you can accept Bitcoin, hold some, pay your bills, hold the rest and get wealthy.
Yeah.
And that's a game changer for small business. Right, that don't have a finance arm, that don't have maybe an advisor that's guiding them on how to buy assets, manage risk, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully that helps disperse the number of individuals in America that are holding Bitcoin, or worldwide that are holding Bitcoin. I'm going to shamelessly plug Buy Federal here, because we're about to, with our partner BurraPay, allow gaming operators, casinos in Vegas and others to accept Bitcoin as payment. So we're really excited about that. And I just think this trend is going to keep continuing and get bigger and bigger. And, you know, if we could get an exemption on capital gains taxes for a de minimis amount that is spent, that would be rocket fuel.
I think even with Square, you can do it so that you can send, like, the business indicates it wants to receive Bitcoin. You can send, use cash.
Oh, nice.
It'll convert to Bitcoin, I believe, and it'll send the vendor the Bitcoin.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's how I've always spent Bitcoin with my wallets is buy, spend.
Yep,
replace. Immediately. Yeah, so that I'm not sending stuff out of cold storage, or, you know, I'm not sending it out of my HODL stack.
Yeah. So, I mean, it makes it very convenient. And I mean, I don't know how it's not taking off more And you're not seeing that all over the country, but it's great to see it finally picking up somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, look, for most of these people, this is probably the first time, meaning this year, or 2025 is probably the first year where they finally felt like, oh, this is something real. Like, this is something I can participate in, because there's been so much talk at the administrative level and in Congress and Senate around crypto at large. This will take some time, but it's great to see that it's happening. Yeah.
And on the other side, you'd love to see maybe Square say, if you're receiving 100% Bitcoin, we'll and you only want to keep 10% in Bitcoin, we again would convert it for you into whatever ratio you want to manage your fiat expenses and needs.
But I do think that's a capability.
Yeah, I mean, it's programmable money.
So anyways.
All right. Moving on to is it back to Lagarde?
No, well, this is
No, this is not Lagarde. No. This is a great clip though. Yeah. I think we have a clip here. Yeah.
Yeah, it's worrisome. You know, the Fed basically has become now just a giant hedge fund. It's lost $1 trillion, you know, and counting. It's going to be a gigantic loss. What it does is borrows money at 5.4% from banks and then dumps it into government bonds. So think what that trade does. That causes the government to think that it's better off than it is. And so that encouraged the government to be short when rates were zero. So why did the government borrow so much in T-bills? Well, because the Fed was buying the bonds and it made it look like yields were going to stay low for long. Remember the low for long phrase. So we've got these multiple problems that are going on, and it endangers the dollar. So that's the basic case.
Instead of the Fed having such large balances, wouldn't the private sector be starting businesses and risking capital and bringing returns and adding to growth? Wouldn't all that money be better if it wasn't with the Fed?
That's right. And we're depending on private equity. So as the banks get squeezed out, because they're lending so much to the Fed, it's literally a floating rate loan from banks to the Federal Reserve so it can buy government bonds. So if that were freed up, that would allow the banks to at least consider a small business loan, an inventory loan, the kinds of things that help the economy grow. And this is on a global basis. It's not just the Fed. It's all the major central banks doing the same thing, meaning taking money from the economy in order to buy government bonds. We need to be clear on that. I heard the previous segment, they talk about money printing. There isn't any money printing on it. It's just money borrowing, and they pay top dollar for it. The Fed pays 5.4 to banks and 5.3 to money market funds, so to the Fidelity and Vanguard and so on.
Has this been like followed up anywhere or sort of validated, or is this...
I don't know. But that's nothing new. I mean, that's how we know the system works. It's UBI for banks.
Right.
I mean, and that's why we were able to do all these rounds of QE and not create inflation, right? We didn't start getting inflation until after COVID, and we started giving money straight to the businesses and straight to the people. And then inflation ripped, right? If you just have UBI for the banks, which is what he's describing, you can increase money supply and not have it not get into the economy because they're just incentivized to play games with the Fed and make easy money.
And I mean, it seems like they've been kind of given the green light to...
Yeah, I think he got the same memo Lagarde got.
Right.
And Lagarde's afraid to talk about it because it's existential to her role in the world, right? So, but yeah, I mean, this is the idea, right? You have a debt crisis around the world. The way for governments to get out of a debt crisis is through inflation. If you want to have inflation, you can't play UBI for banks. You have to actually get the money into the economy and grow, baby, grow, drill, baby, drill, produce trips, get the market to rip, get GDP up, right? Get growth relative to your debt low, or get growth high relative to your debt. And so that's going to be inflationary. So we're going to need a scapegoat.
Right.
So the Fed is going to become the scapegoat.
Where would you put Bitcoin network in age compared to the internet? So let's say was born in the 60s, maybe.
Where did that question come from?
Well, I'm trying to, the sort of the notes here are, is the fiat debt spiral going to implode in the next 5 years?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And so I think that there's like a time where
you're equating that to the tech bubble.
But if there were 10 years left in the fiat spiral, let's say,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
And it was, let's say that on that trajectory, that the last 5 years were 99% of the death spiral. So in year six, you're like, I don't see it coming. Year five, you're like, things have changed. And then things change drastically in the next 4 years.
I have this conversation with a friend, and hopefully he's listening because he'll know who he is. Like, when does this end, so to speak, right?
Let's compare. But the thing I want to say about that is the internet probably took 40 years to really become ubiquitous.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe 35 to 45 years.
So the internet was like
the first 20 years. It wasn't commercial though.
Yeah, but the internet was a new sector of the economy, a new emerging sector of the economy that required infrastructure. And I think what really blew that up is that the vision and the infrastructure required, the capital infrastructure or the capital allocation to the infrastructure required to get us to where the internet is today was so massive. And the dot-com companies at the time couldn't fill those pipes, right? The software had not caught up to the infrastructure. The vision was there, but the actual build out wasn't, right? AI and cryptocurrency are not bounded by similar structures.
And they're built on similar structures where Bitcoin is a digital network. So I think you get exponential.
Bitcoin is an education adoption, a human adoption dilemma. It's people not understanding the problem they have and how to fix it. AI is comparable, but moving at a totally different rate. And I think not similar to the dot-com era because of this. And this is where I was going with this whole thing. When you have you have AI is now positioned as a global hegemon problem. If US AI has to compete against China AI, you cannot afford to be the second class AI entity. You have to be there. So if getting to the point of like, when does the debt Ponzi collapse? I don't think it collapses until the government has all the resources they need, all the energy they need. They've locked down the Western Hemisphere. They've released the technocratic surveillance state so that they have total control in their walled garden. Then we can let the debt collapse and we can restructure the dollar relative to Bitcoin and gold. But up until that point, they're going to try and keep the Ponzi going as long as possible.
But once they get you in that panopticon,
they don't get those resources. It's existential, right? If the U.S. doesn't thread this needle, if they don't get manufacturing and energy production and raw materials and chips and the technocratic birdcage installed prior to losing control of the debt cycle, then we significantly lose our position in the world. So it's existential to the survival of the United States as a world stage player. So I think they will try and keep
the Ponzi going as long as possible. But don't you think the overarching trajectory is a one world government? And once you have the one world government, okay, so you have a digital panopticon. They say, look, currency doesn't even matter. They're just digital units. We have a certain amount of energy for humanity, and we'll use energy units as representations of
value. How would I describe it? So value. You have, what would be a good analogy? Okay. You have the board that owns the league, the professional sports league.
Right.
And then you have the managers managing the sports teams.
Right.
And you have serious investors that own those teams, but they're not above
the total
the
board.
League, the board right. of the league. Right. So yeah, when we see Larry Fink and others at the world, that we're looking at the board level seats. And then underneath that you have China, Team Russia, Team USA, and they're competing with resources and players and knowledge and compute and war and the military, industrial, et cetera, right? These are all the tools on their of their team. And they're fighting for status within that league that sits underneath the board. So if we don't want to be the worst team in the league,
right,
which makes it really hard to get the budget to build the New York Yankees, right? Once you're down there, it's really hard to get back up. We're going to do everything we can to try and stay as one of the top three teams. That's the analogy I'm trying to make.
And then maybe you think of yourself maybe as a global citizen. You take yourself out of that framework.
Well, if you have the capability, if you have the capability, good for you. But the average person doesn't. And that's, the question, getting back to when does the fiat debt spiral implode? That means when do we stop issuing debt? When do we quit expanding the debt? Because it's once we contract and we get massive deflation, that's when fiat implodes. So I believe they won't risk doing that until they have a strong enough team on the field that they think they can still compete even after impoverishing the average citizen, because that's what deflation will do, right? You might still have cheap food. You might still have a cheap car and a really cheap cell phone because AI has made everything cheap. But your ability to attain wealth and move freely through a society will be significantly limited, right? So that I don't think they can afford that implosion yet. I think they will eventually implement that, but I don't think that they can afford it yet because they don't have their team built.
That's an interesting perspective. All right, so we got Rick Ryder emerges at the Fed chair contender, more BlackRock. Maybe we could play this clip.
What do you think the ideal portfolio is supposed to look like today? We're surrounded by investors. We're surrounded quite literally by financial advisors who are thinking about that, retail investors who are watching. I mean, what does it look like today?
Very different than the past. So maybe I'll start with the equity market. I mean, the first thing I would say, we're going through the most extraordinary technology dynamic I've ever seen before. I would stay long equities. By the way, you can buy volatility very cheaply to manage your exposure. I'd stay long equities oriented to where growth in technology is. In fixed income is amazing. You're still clipping 6%. Would I stay 5 years in on the curve? I'd still clip that coupon. We're extending a little bit out. And then quite frankly, I mean, there's some interesting things to do in privates, bespoke markets. And I think hard assets have to enter the equation today. Gold, Bitcoin, things that give you a little bit of ballast in the portfolio against potential for currency depreciation.
When you talk about Bitcoin should be part of the portfolio, what kind of percentage are you thinking about? Is it a 5%, which generally seems to be what people are talking about, more or less?
It seems high to me. So I run our global allocation fund. Mm-hmm. You know, we're running long equities. You know, we're heavy income. You know, we're running, you know, in the 3-5% region on gold. Gold strikes me today as a better currency hedge. Bitcoin tends to trade with vol, tends to trade with the NASDAQ. So we're running considerably lower than that in crypto. I just think it's going to go up, and I think it's a good expression. But 5 seems high to me, but it depends where you are in your life and how much risk you want to take.
Well, we'll see you on the stage, the big stage, I said, as the headline speaker, the keynote today. Rick Reed.
He was Rickrolling Bitcoin there.
So what do you think, Cedric? Do you think, the question here is a Bitcoin Fed, that's questionable, number one. Will there be a Bitcoin Fed? Fed that supports Bitcoin versus be dovish or hawkish? Do you think, number one, do you think we'll have a Federal Reserve ever that supports Bitcoin? And I think support it means it's on their balance sheet.
I think the Federal Reserve goes away or gets transformed drastically over the next 8 to 10 years. I think it's going to be replaced by less and less people, more and more algorithms, or one algorithm, and just be programmable by a small committee. And I think that will try to be a way that they could try to bring more trust to the system. Mm-hmm. There's less there's nobody involved. It's got algorithmic emissions.
Do you think it's Bitcoin independent, or do you think it's basically a state-run central bank, like the People's Bank of China?
I think it gets closer to the state, yeah. Mm-hmm. and or the Fed gets morphed or taken over or combines with the Treasury. That to me seemed very much like Bitcoin is still put in its place. But he seemed very pro like risk assets and easy money. And but I think it was very clever for BlackRock to still diminish Bitcoin's place in the portfolio from a long term. They want to slow this thing down, roll it out very slow, get their position.
Well, he also positioned it as, you know, as currency is devalued. So as a currency hedge.
Right.
And
that gold's better.
You know, and that's everything that we're talking about, right? To support the kind of growth that the administration wants, to bring AI to the forefront, to gather all these raw materials that we need, that requires devaluing the dollar. I mean, it's going to happen, right? I mean, we don't have enough taxable revenue at the Treasury level to pay the interest. So money's getting created. We call it printing or call it borrowing, whatever you want to call it. Monetary units are going to expand and get increased, and it's going to reduce the purchasing power of the dollar. So in that environment, stocks, gold, Bitcoin will appreciate. And so I don't, to me, it's like, I love it when all these advisors stand around, because I used to be one of them, stand around and like, oh my God, what is Rick saying? Like, oh my God, wow, this is insane. Like, no, dude, this is like common freaking sense. And you should have been able to predict this before Rick ever said a thing, right?
Yeah.
He's not going to say anything new. He's not going to say what they're really discussing in the boardroom. He's not going to talk about like the kind of behind the scenes conversations they're having about impending shit, right? And so, you know, having a small position of Bitcoin in the portfolio, be responsible. Like if it takes Rick to get you there, okay. But
the overton window has moved. I mean, the interviewer started at 5%, which is different than the 1 to 2 we've heard in the past.
That's for sure. The overton window has shifted 100%.
And it's just part of the conversation now. It's less.
But I think the question is, you know, is the Bitcoin Fed, would it be dovish or hawkish? I think the dovishness or hawkishness depends on what the government needs right now. Mm-hmm. Right. When we're in a fiscal dominance environment where we're in a reorganization of global power structures, it's what does the government need, not what do the people need. So I think it's dovish until which time, if we're lucky enough to rebalance our debt to GDP, our debt to income ratios, whatever you want to look at it. Once that's more stable, then we can start thinking about a hawkish Fed again.
Yeah. Owen Benjamin, who rails on Bitcoin, he's kind of a interesting dude otherwise. I don't know if you know who he is. His backstory is a little bit of like he was a comedian. He you know, was very, I guess, successful or moderately successful, and then decided to kind of like go get a farm, just get out of the system. He does a little bit on X, sort of trying to just be very, very independent. And very independent mining. He found that just being a comedian was really like just trying to shill liquor and degeneracy, basically, you know. So, but he said something that I thought was interesting on Trump. He said, Trump is going to be the fall guy for the economic system that was a mathematical inevitability that has nothing to do with him. He's not a victim. His narcissism made him susceptible to accepting the role. First is Judas goat, then is scapegoat. The narcissism and corruption of the left-wing establishment to ignore the laws around immigration has led to the logical outcome of corruption enforcement that is permitted to use a new level of force without consequence. You can't win a rigged game unless you also become corrupt. The game is about power acquisition, so this permanent dynamic will always doom participants. But I think it's interesting that you're saying that it fits one of my theories about how they use both parties as just pendulum back and forth. And in a lot of ways, I don't think the right would have accepted Biden and Harris destroying the economy in such moronic ways. You get Trump destroying the economy maybe in ways that are experimental but defensible by the right. And the right tends to be more hardcore economic sort of conservative. So I don't know. It'd be interesting if they destroyed the economy on Trump's watch. I think going into this, everyone thought nothing could be better for the economy than Trump. In the two-party system, where I think it's a false dichotomy, but I think a lot of people saw Trump as very pro or very positive for the potential economic outcomes of America in at least the first year. And I think a lot of people have been disappointed maybe for the first 12 months. And they said from the get-go it would be pain for Wall Street or something like along those lines, mm-hmm. and gains for Main Street down the road. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if Main Street's felt that. I don't think so. So interesting first year. Mm-hmm. See how the next year goes.
And yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know, for the way I think about it, the way I've always looked at Trump is he's a disruptor. I think he fits in perfectly with the fourth turning. Either he read the book and like raised his hand and said, I'll be that guy. Or the fourth turning is very, very much predictive in regards to just the evolution of societies. And so he fits that role, right? Where all these old institutions that were prominent and important to the past global structure are going to be torn apart. And that includes IMF, the UN, the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, the Federal Reserve, et cetera. And he's disruptive and I think brave enough, or maybe like he said, egotistical enough to be like, yeah, we're just going to go do what we need to do. What's right for America. Right. And what's right for America is meaning this team analogy, right? We want to make sure we stay in the top three. We don't want to go down further. Mm. We don't want there to be a top two and America not be in it. Right. So worst case scenario, top three. And so he's going to be fighting to maintain that. And I think all rules are out the window. And he's got no problem doing that. So as a disruptor and somebody who can embrace change, you need somebody with that kind of mentality. And so I think he fits right into where we are in history. Right. It's like you can't write the script any better.
Yeah. We'll see. I don't know if I agree with all of that. But I think time will tell. I think we have a little bit more Trump news here before we roll out. So he sued JP Morgan over alleged debanking. This is interesting. I mean, how much of this is here? I'll read this. President Trump has filed a lawsuit against JP Morgan Chase and its CEO, Jamie Dimon, seeking at least $5 billion in damages. The suit accuses the bank of debanking him and his affiliated businesses for politically motivated reasons, primarily tied to events following the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. The key details from the reports, filing location was filed in Florida, state court in Miami. And it names Trump personally, along with several of his hospitality companies as plaintiffs. The core allegations, JP Morgan allegedly closed on restricted multiple accounts belonging to Trump and his entities in 2021. The decision is claimed to stem from political and social motivations to distance the bank from Trump post January 6th, rather than legitimate business or regulatory reasons. Specific claims include trade libel, breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And the suit references JP Morgan allegedly placing Trump-related entities on a blacklist and violating its own code of conduct. The demands are at least $5 billion in damages plus a jury trial. I don't know. This, I think this could be kayfabe. And it can be money laundering. And it can... This goes back to when I first got... the world was changing a lot in 2016. Trying to figure out what's going on. Trump's becoming president. You're hearing the Russian hoax, trying to unravel this thing. I remember going down the Roger Stone rabbit hole. One of the things I think he wrote about in his book was that some of these fights are not real.
Right.
So, you know, fights over a damaged art painting worth $100 million. And there's a court judgment, right? Well, the judge could be in on it. And these guys just want to move money without paying taxes. Or shield income. There's lots of different ways to do money laundering with fine art.
So, but how do you think this case relates to that?
Well, so I'm saying I'm not sure that JP Morgan is not in on the transition to the CBDC. I understand it threatens their deposit business.
You're just using that.
I understand it threatens their yield business.
Was money transmission?
No, I'm just saying I don't know what's actually happening here, and I don't know. I do believe that maybe Trump was debanked. It doesn't seem like it derailed him. The family has said that before. I don't know what to what extent. I don't know how much it was. And I agree with you that there are warring factions, but I still see them as sort of the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Senators, where there's a bit of hand in hand in the arm wrestling where you win, I win. I want to be the bad guy. There's a lot more to be gained by being.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is this in the context of how pro tokenization Jamie has become in the last year.
Sure.
And
that they're the authorized participant on the Bitcoin ETF. Mm-hmm. They're already picks and shovels on Bitcoin.
They're deeply embedded,
or the I believe probably the real power behind Ethereum. Mm-hmm. So they're part of everything Trump's going to move towards. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a real fight. Mm-hmm. I would venture to say Jamie Dimon and Trump have dinner at some point in the future.
Well,
the way Powell and Trump hung out and did a video shoot for mainstream media a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I get you, man. There could be other reasons for this. And it could just be narrative building. It could be all sorts of things.
But I also, what I find interesting, so like, I don't believe the Maduro story that we've been fed, but I do think that it's important to reckon with it because it's the official story. So let's say that Maduro is part of a CIA business that's been going on for a long time. And he agrees to come in, and the true kidnapping was more of a handover. Or do you get what I'm getting
at? Yeah, I get what you're getting at.
But we're fed a different story. Mm-hmm. But all the other governments publicly agree to the official story. And so that has an effect on the world and sort of official communications and policy and all. Even if you don't agree or believe it, you still have to reckon with it because the world is sort of going along with it. So that's what I'm saying. So
yeah.
This doesn't...
I think that's where I always keep coming back. We've kind of hit this several times today, but if you come back to like who's sitting at the board level, making the financial decisions that these different countries, China, United States, Russia, UAE, are involved in the financing of all these different things, then coming from that level, you can see, okay, well, we need this here, we need that there, we need a structure here, we need to build chips there, we need oil from here, we need it to be this. You start to build that architecture, like, okay, now we need to create a pitch. Here's the pitch. And here's how this company wins there, and this company wins there, and this country wins this, and this country gets that. And we started, this is the Simon Dixon, like, we're gonna, it like makes it look like war and chaos, but really it's just a restructuring directed by the board. Because they are the ones that hold the purse strings, right? So from that perspective, maybe this fits in somewhere in that narrative and it becomes completely evident to us, you know, at some point in the future. We're like, ah, now it makes sense.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll get closer. This has been an awesome show as usual. Love getting together with you.
Likewise.
This is Bitcoin Center. This was live stream number 38 brought to you by Byte Federal. Please hit like and subscribe. Take self-custody and go bank yourself. Go to a Bitcoin ATM, Byte Federal Bitcoin ATM.
Download our wallet, buy your first Bitcoin, then move it to self-custody in our vault.
And you don't have to buy a whole Bitcoin. You could buy fractions or sats or just $5 or $10 of Bitcoin at a time. So try to think, though, in sats and not dollars. That's a superpower, I think.
I agree.
Thinking in using Bitcoin as your denominator or your unit of account. From the very get-go, I think it's a superpower emotionally, sort of gives you sort of, I think, future financial sovereignty on the way. I think that it's empowering, but also I think you'll just make better calculations throughout your entire life.
Yep.
So, all right. I don't know if we have any comments or questions from the peanut gallery.
All right.
Let's roll out.
And subscribe. Thanks for joining us.
See you next week. Peace. Tuesdays at 2:00.